This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Well, it had to happen eventually. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's reign at Manchester United is over. By the end, he resembled a bee wandering around slowly on the pavement, ready to be put out of his misery. Not often the bee gets to film a leaving video, though. I guess here's where the analogy ends. What's the verdict then? A good guy who did okay in a job he should never have got? And will this change make any difference given what's above him? There haven't been many successful Manchester United managers and fewer interim to the interim ones. Like everyone else, we'll forget that Watford even played in Saturday's game and we won't have enough time to do justice to a great weekend of football. The assist of Cancelo, the strike of Rodri, Kante's run, Klopp and Arteta's fisticuffs, a classic between Burnley and Palace. Yes, really, hotel-bound Eddie Howe sees his side falling to the bottom. The authentic Steven Gerrard, the insistent Antonio Conte. What if I don't want to cheer right at this second? All that plus some ludicrous Fitbar, drug-induced fever dreams about Barry, and Matt Janssen sings the songs of David Gray. Your questions, of course, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, welcome back from your holiday, much missed, Barry Glendening.
Hello, Max. Thank you.
Hello, Simon Burnton.
Hi.
And hello, Troy Townsend.
Hi, Max.
Chanzo says, could be a long pod. Yes, it could be. A lot of things happened. Steve says, why have you got Simon on? Did something happen in Watford? Well, let's start there, shall we? Solskjaer's gone. Manchester United kindly made the announcement on Sunday morning instead of the customary 5 minutes after Football Weekly stops recording on a Monday. We'll get into the farewell video, who replaces him in the interim and the long term. But first, an email from Imi, who says, dear Football Weekly, while I'm sure you are all, brackets Wilson, patting yourself on the back following Ole being sacked, I just wanted to give the perspective of a Man United fan. Ole took over from a truly, utterly, desperately rotten situation created by Mourinho. There was a toxic culture, big egos and complete apathy from the players, which does sound a bit like Saturday. But anyway, the 3-2 win over Newcastle that season still is the worst performance I've ever seen from a Manchester United team in terms of effort, cohesion and application. The fact that Ole turned it round so quickly is a minor miracle. He got rid of that culture and players and was able to restore pride in the club. Yes, he failed to live up to the heights of the Fergie years, as many have. On the whole, we've played attacking football. He's promoted youngsters and made me proud of the club again. While you have every right to point out his shortcomings, please put in perspective the great work he has done, given how Mourinho nearly destroyed the club. Thanks all for the great content. Best wishes, Imi. Barry, does he make a good point?
He makes an interesting point. I wouldn't necessarily agree it's a good point. Ole hasn't always been a terrible Manchester United manager. And I do remember that atmosphere at United was absolutely toxic when he was given the job as an interim manager. He did well for a while. We had former Manchester United players like Rio Ferdinand announcing that he should be allowed to write his own contract, put whatever number he liked on it and sign it immediately after they'd got a fairly fortuitous Champions League win against PSG. This, incidentally, the same Rio Ferdinand who seems to think be manoeuvring to become director of football at the club, but who seems to make very knee-jerk decisions or judgments as a pundit. I suppose we're all guilty of that. It's also important to remember that as good as Sir Alex Ferguson was as Manchester United manager, a lot of the mess they're in at the moment is entirely his fault because he got involved in this petty squabble over a racehorse with United's former owners that prompted them to sell to the Glazers, who got Ed Woodward in on board to help negotiate the deal. They installed him in a big position of power at the club. And while he's been good as a commercial guy, he has shamefully neglected the playing side of things. So that's all kind of background, which I think needs to be mentioned. I don't remember the Newcastle game that our correspondent mentions as the worst they've ever seen United play, but I would be very surprised if they were worse in that game than they were on Saturday against Watford, when the 4-1 scoreline very much flattered United. Watford probably should have won by a lot more. suspect it wasn't as bad as the hiding they got from Liverpool, or the different kind of hiding they got from Manchester City, who almost took pity on them. But it is correct to say he hasn't always been a terrible manager, but he clearly isn't tactically savvy enough to be Manchester United manager. And I think it's probably the best for everyone, including himself, that he has been finally put out of his misery, because he's aged about 30 years physically in the last 6 months. And I wonder if when he finally has time to kick back and relax and go back to Norway or do whatever he plans to do to unwind after this really stressful time, he'll be like Steve Bruce at the cricket, just like a boulder has been lifted off his shoulder and just looking happy and young again.
Oh yeah, Barney Ronay's piece saying, look, nobody in the post-war years has managed as many games without winning a trophy. Solskjaer took a team that had finished second the season before. 300 million nets been spent on players in his time. United currently have four of the five best paid players in the league, yet this Solskjaer team still never gave any sense of developing a clear style of play. I mean, considering all of that, Simon, they're not good, are they?
I think Solskjaer was a good answer to the question that they were asking at Old Trafford after Mourinho went. But he's not been the right answer to any question. Like after the first 3-4 months, he's not been the right answer at any point, I think. And the real wheels have really come off these last few months. De Gea gave an interview to the BBC after Saturday's game, which I thought was extraordinary. And there were two sentences in particular.
Amazing, weren't they?
that I would like to say. So the first one, he's talking about how hard as a moment this is. And he says, I've been through difficult moments at this club, to be honest, for a long time. He's been there for a while now, and it's been really bad for a really long time. It is not a Solskjaer has manufactured this. He has been having a bad time for many years at Manchester United. Anyway, he continues, at the moment, we're in a very difficult situation. We don't know what to do with the ball. We don't know how to defend properly. We're conceding a lot of goals. I mean, that sentence is the most savage indictment of a sitting manager that I think I've ever heard a major player say. He is saying they're a disorganised rabble. And while we all saw that, while he was still at the club, for his players to be saying that in public was extraordinary. And there was nowhere to go after. I heard that on Radio 5 on the way back from Vicarage Road, and immediately there was nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go after players start saying that kind of stuff.
Troy, a lot of people will say, rightly, that it isn't just Solskjaer, and you probably have better knowledge of what happens, you know, behind the scenes at a football club and above Solskjaer. You know, their recruitment of, their obsession with the past and, inverted commas, DNA. It's nice, right? We all want one of our own. We all want that. But, you know, Darren Fletcher's there, his first job in football, really. Michael Carrick's first job in football. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, barely any experience, any akin to a top football club. What are they doing?
It's a mess, isn't it? There's a couple of things that have surprised me about the situation, and as just recently, not as it's developed, because as it's developed has proved that Man United board are not a footballing board. You know, he was an interim manager. They got excited and thought, you know what? No, it's perfect. It fits. It looks well. We're playing well on the pitch, although I still think at any stage they've never achieved anything near what they should have done with the quality on the pitch. They've added to that quality time and time again. And in a matter of fact, I've got worse as a football team, if you want me to be totally honest. Behind the scenes, who knows what goes on? Was he the man in charge? Was he the one who was making all the final decisions? I don't think that has been raised a lot. He was a nice guy put in a position that actually maybe he should have turned down after the interim position. Was he really ever going to be good enough to manage Manchester United? And it's okay saying, well, they had some great results. Well, you're going to have some great results because you've got some absolute top quality players. But every time they started 90 minutes of football, they look lost. They get rattled at half time. They come out, they turn a result around. That's not how you continue to try and develop you know, players who, you know, I heard what you said about the comments about Mourinho, but aren't those comments could seriously be levelled at this same group of players now? Because I think they've dictated on the field of play the way that Man United are supposed to play or turn up and play at various levels. So I'm... you don't want to go pile in because he is a nice guy. But when has a nice guy ever, ever been in charge of such a big football club and then failed so miserably? There's a lot of questions that need to be asked. There's a lot of questions of those players. There's a lot of questions behind the scenes. None of his backroom staff have gone. But yet I don't see them as a side that looks... I look at... Sorry to transgress a little bit. I look at the likes of Brighton and I look at the likes of Leeds and I look at the likes of those clubs and see how well those players have been coached. You can tell there's a style, there's an ethos of running through both football clubs. I don't know what this Manchester United is. So to keep the coaching staff then says that the problem was all about Ollie. So Man United have created this issue themselves. So I'm a little bit, I don't know what's going on. I'd love to be behind the scenes, Max. That's probably the answer that I should have given at the beginning.
David says, why didn't Max get a sit-down interview when he left Soccer AM? Chris says, will United try and save time by filming both welcome and goodbye videos at the same time? I found it, Barry, I don't know what the point of it was. It seemed slightly odd. But he came when he got emotional when he was talking about what a top bloke Michael Carrick was. I thought, I spend a lot of time in this podcast when we do serious things saying, look, it's more important to be kind than successful. And if that's the case, you know, Ollie's got his priorities absolutely bang on.
Yeah, I'm a bit baffled by that video. I don't recall any other high profile manager doing it or any other manager at all doing it. Usually they get sacked. You don't hear from them for a while. There's a statement put out by the League Managers Association in which they, you know, go through all the usual platitudes. Then they lie low for a few months and turn up on the goals on Sunday sofa to remind everyone, hey, I'm still here and I'm available for work. Now, the cynic in me presumed this was some pathetic stunt by the much maligned social media department to wring every last ounce of whatever it is they call it out of the Ollie reign. But Andy Mitten and I think Jamie Jackson as well, who are both far better informed about what goes on at the club than I am, say that Ollie wanted to do it. Now, in time, I'm sure we'll get a very long, you know, the true story of Ollie's dismissal published in various places, and we'll probably find out if he really did want to do it or not. I thought it was a bit cruel, but yeah, it was quite touching. But no one doubts he's a nice guy, or not many people do anyway. So, and it must be a wrench for him. Just one thing about what goes on about behind the scenes. I wonder how much influence Sir Alex Ferguson still has at the club. He's a bit like the spectre at the feast. He's always there in the director's box. And it sort of reminds me of Succession a bit. He's like Logan Roy.
Barry, give it away. I haven't watched it yet. Don't give it away.
Who is his latest favourite child who's desperate to please him? Because we've had Moisey, we've had Ollie, Carrick and Fletcher are there now. I have a feeling Sir Alex possibly is still running the show there and has a major input in big decisions.
They seem to prioritize, or at least revel in, the fact that they employ nice guys and treat them nicely, and that never was United's thing. As I remember Alex Ferguson being the most heartless bastard. That, you know, suddenly Mark Hughes or Kanchelskis or Yapstam, they'd be out. There'd be no drop in their performances. They're just gone. He thinks that United can do a bit better. They're gone. They're out. It doesn't matter what they like. It doesn't matter how long they've played for the club. If United can do better, they're out. So how has it become jobs for the boys? And, you know, and maybe Sir Alex Ferguson's pulling the strings so that They don't make change. That's not what Ferguson ever was. And one other thing. Sometimes I sit at home and I watch a movie or something with my wife, right? And I find that she is checking her phone more than she's watching the film, right? And it's really annoying to me. That is an annoying feeling. It feels like every time the camera cuts to the Manchester United bench, Carrick's on his iPad. Is it like, what is he doing on his iPad? He's checking WhatsApp or something. I don't understand. I don't understand why Solskjaer likes him at all.
Be interesting to see if Carrick, you know, on the Tuesday night is doing the same every time it cuts to him. I mean, speaking of jobs for the boys, Simshi says, would giving the interim manager role to Ronaldo be the most glorious thing to behold as a non-United fan? Joe, how much would you all love to see Roy Keane coming in as interim manager? What do you make, Troy, of interim, Carrick interim full-time manager as a plan? Seems like there isn't one, right?
Well, listen, the delay in sacking Solskjaer has caused Man United massive problems. Some say Conte was never the choice. Conte says he was waiting for the job, so had they spoken to him. But you look at the way that I thought Dean Smith sacking was harsh. Norwich have sacked, but yet they prepared themselves, you know, just before the international break to make change so that they can try and galvanise their season. United have hung on and have hung on and have hung on. Are they talking to people? Already this in the last 24 hours, I've seen five names linked. But is that five names that are actually interested in the job? Because this massive football club that we're talking about, no one seems to want it. So maybe they have to have the interim before maybe naming another interim. I don't know, because is it true that Poch is ready at the end of the season? Is it true that Ten Hag may be interested? They're Manchester United Football Club, supposed to be the biggest global club in the world. And they're announcing an interim before looking at probably us four and thinking, could we do the job before they name someone who, you know, is prepared to do the job? It's a shambles from top to bottom. I agree with the Sir Alex Ferguson shout. Far too much influence. And I think that influence is a shadow over anybody that would possibly take that role.
A moment of reflection for the Wilson Churn, who needs to find new things to say about Manchester United. Although he has written a piece saying that while Ronaldo is still there, they can't progress. So he is still capable of writing very much the same article. The game itself, Watford were good, eh, Simon, weren't they?
Watford were good. I did get a sense even approaching the game. I mean, we can't leave.
This is very much, anyway, Mrs. Lincoln, what did you think of the play?
Yeah, it's one of those games that it's hard entirely to judge one team because the other is so appalling. But Watford were good. And what was good was the intensity. And that was what was needed to beat Manchester United. We didn't need a lot more than intensity because they lacked organisation and calm and were ready to collapse. Particularly good, the three-man midfield, which basically had a passer, a carrier, and a harrier. And Tom Cleverley is, I mean, he's a limited player in lots of ways, but he throws himself into games. And when I saw his name on the team sheet, I knew that we would have the intensity that we needed to win the game.
I thought, I've written here, has Tom Cleverley been playing since the Premier League began? Like, sort of, he looks quite young still, but he must be pushing 50. And actually, would be quite useful in the Manchester United centre midfield, wouldn't he?
Well, he used to be in it, didn't he?
Exactly, yeah, he did. I enjoyed Dennis taking his shirt and then the sort of GPS sports bra off, turning, you know, a wild celebration to a bit of a striptease. You know, like if you haven't, how many clothes do you have on? You have to keep taking them off until you are totally shirtless and you can knee slide in front of the fans. But look, good on Ranieri, eh? Sorry, Barry, you leaned in to say something.
I was just going to say he didn't factor in the negative impact this will have on his running stats because he sprinted and did a knee slide, which won't turn up on his game stats because he'd removed his GPS bra.
that's a very good point, isn't it? I hadn't thought about that. So anyway, we will no doubt talk more Manchester United as the days and weeks progress.
Is that it? Is that the whole Watford bit?
Oh, mate, you were lucky to get that, Simon. I did like this tweet from Bearded Genius saying, nothing will change the affection United fans have for Ole. He was given the chance to do his dream job and he did his best. I just hope the club do this one thing right and let Old Trafford say goodbye properly. Something respectful, like Ian Brown with nunchucks in the centre circle. That video of Ian Brown and nunchucks was very... I can't remember who tweeted, you know, and then Indiana Jones just there with a gun. You know, that brilliant. It was like that Indiana Jones scene, wasn't it? Anyway, we digress, probably for the better. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do all those teams who are at the top of the league and are really good. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's do the best three teams in the division who are making this all look quite easy at the moment. Liverpool 4, Arsenal 0. I mean, I thought actually, Troy, Arsenal started this game quite well and for 25 minutes had a plan. Obviously, you've got to be deep and try and counter. But Liverpool are so relentless. And if you give them an inch...
but a game doesn't last 25 minutes, does it? And they made more passes in their own box than what they did anywhere else on the football pitch. And I just couldn't... the mark of a good manager is then to then, what are we going to do next? What are we going to do to impress on Liverpool next? And I didn't think Arteta did that. You know, there was this passing around the box, which I don't get. Ben White drove out of defence at one time, got caught immediately under pressure. And in the end, they decided to pass around the box and then just smash it up the pitch for Liverpool to then regain and then apply the pressure on again. I find it hard to
But sorry, Troy, it is quite hard to play against Liverpool.
Yes, but all of a sudden, Arsenal is supposed to be this great football team. So if you're a great football team, you take on whoever you're against at that moment and you take them on. You go to Anfield and you show no fear. And like I said, I thought Arsenal then decided to get deeper and deeper by passing the ball behind Ramsdale more and more and then just smashing the ball up the football pitch. But one of the guys are going to hopefully acknowledge the fact that Arteta has a massive part to play in the resurgence of Liverpool during that game and scoring the opening goal by the way that he decided to... I don't know what he was trying to do with Klopp, to be totally honest, because at one point he was in his face. Then when he had a bit of protection, he seemed to get more angry than what he was when he was in Klopp's face. I don't understand that.
leave it, Janet. It's not worth it.
It was crazy. It? But listen, 20 minutes at Anfield, nip and tuck is okay. But like once Liverpool went ahead, there was only one result. And I felt that Arsenal didn't perform to any kind of way that they have been recently, but they haven't met a top side like Liverpool recently, have they?
There were two moments that I loved, Barry. One was Salah taking the ball out of the sky like it was a beanbag, just sort of on his toe. It's like he deflated the ball and it landed. And the other was Jota's, I think it's now called a pre-assist, a sort of glancing header through before the Salah goal. And he is a special player, isn't he? And he's doing exactly what, you know, in terms of, we talked about Manchester United's recruitment a bit, but like buying a player that pushes the other three, pushes Firmino, Mane and Salah and can do more than one of those jobs and is doing it brilliantly.
Well, I'm not sure it's even at a stage where he's pushing them now. He seems to have become first choice ahead of Roberto Firmino. He's a splendid player. I loved his goal. After Nuno Tavares had given the ball, well, he'd done brilliantly to win the ball, they gave it away, and that was indicative of Arsenal's performance. They just kept giving the ball away stupidly, and you cannot do that against Liverpool. But yeah, Jota, I don't think there was any doubt he was going to be an excellent signing, and he bided his time and is now more or less a first team regular. I mean, in this section we're talking about the teams that are good, the three outstanding teams in the Premier League, and I think Brendan Rodgers, Rafa Benitez and Mikel Arteta, the managers of the teams who are supposed to be challenging them, although Ole Gunnar Solskjaer are a drink, because his dismissal has completely shut down any conversation about how bad their team's performances were. Leicester were shocking, Everton were shocking, and Arsenal were shocking against the three best teams in the league.
Why are you looking at me when you said Everton are shocking, Barry?
I don't think it's your fault.
Well, let's move on.
You are partly culpable in a very small way.
let's talk about that City-Everton game then. I did like Pep's quote, you know, when one team doesn't want to play, it's difficult. You know,
wasn't that difficult?
Poor old Andros is, you know, he's just part of a bus, Troy, isn't he? That's all he is.
Oh dear. I don't know if I went there in anticipation. Anticipation of what, I asked myself, to be totally honest, because you're playing Man City and you're playing Man City without you know, some very, very important players for Everton. Everton have basically got one starting 11 with a couple of subs. So if you've got Mina injured, Decore injured, Calvert-Lewin injured, Damari Gray picks up an injury after 11 minutes after having a, or how many minutes, I don't even know, but after having a really good start, to be totally honest, against Kyle Walker, he took him on two runs that if he was a little bit more clinical with his final ball or final shot, then maybe we could be talking about a different game. And I think one of those, the final part, I think it was a shot, actually ended with his abductor injury. And when he went down, you then said, oh no. Because he was a massive outlet on that side, and City just were City. They gained control. They passed the ball with absolute ease. They picked pockets with absolute ease. You talk about Salah bringing the ball down. There was one, Foden, which was right in front of me from a crossfield ball that you've got no right to control the ball in the way that he did. Just stopped it still out the air, bam. I knew what he was going to do next. You've absolutely got no right to do that. And I'm disgusted that he tried to do it in front of me as well, to be totally honest. But that's the way it is. Two of the three goals, as we'll all know, were unbelievable. They were exceptional, of such a high level. And Everton ran about a lot. I mean, that's probably all I can say about Everton's performance. They ran and they ran. Sometimes into each other, sometimes with no purpose. They were poor. They were really, really poor. You can't hide the fact about that. But Man City are a great team, as we all know.
So, Simon, did you prefer Cancelo's assist with the outside of his boot, or did you prefer Rodri's absolute pile driver? Two very different uses of the same part of the body.
I thought that Cancelo's assist was just so gorgeous. And there was a perfect behind the player camera angle, which I guess we all needed to be able to fully savour it. But to be honest, if they cancelled football for the next 6 months and just showed that assist on repeat, I would watch it. I would watch Match of the Day every Saturday night for an hour and a half of that assist on repeat. That would be just fine. That Cancelo assist, it's just as good as football gets. Cannot be better than that assist.
Man City's army of footballing superchildren, Gary Neville called them clones on Sky. Cole Palmer, James McAtee wearing number 87. Renzo says, Edison, Ake and Palmer, City's progressive trio. That is Ake and Palmer. I mean, that is really... I'm here all week, he says. Blimey, that is pushing it. Palmer was brilliant, wasn't he? David says, I'd love to hear more of the mysterious three-key crypto partnership with City, especially the man with the checked suit and the ginger beard. We are going to hopefully do a bit more on football's burgeoning relationship with cryptocurrency. I wrote an article about it, non-fungible tokens, by the end of which I didn't know what they were, so anyone reading it wouldn't have known either.
I have a friend who's a big tech nerd, and I've made an appointment to sit down with him tomorrow, and he's going to explain it all to me, because I'm none the wiser. I'm like you, Max. Well, I know even less than you, because I couldn't even begin to write an article on it at the moment.
We can make Barry a non-fungible token, and then people can buy his face or something like that. Anyway, Leicester 3, Chelsea. I mean, almost certainly we'll all be wrong and everyone will be millionaires, but I believe your investments can go up and down, is what you're meant to say at this stage. Chelsea won 3-0 at Leicester. Frighteningly straightforward, this, wasn't it? Troy, what do you want to say? Kante's goal was brilliant. Rudiger is, you know, is better than most centre forwards, etc.
Yeah, it was as much as a stroll in the park as what I watched live yesterday. It honestly, you know, maybe it was Brendan believing the rumours that he could be the next interim manager at Manchester United or permanent manager. I don't know what stage he was coming in, but his side is suffering. His side is suffering. But again, let's not focus on that. Let's focus on the way that Chelsea are playing. They've got their mojo back. There was questions after the defeat against Man City, to be honest, where City won quite comfortably. And then there were question marks, you know, but they've, Lukaku's not playing, Werner's not playing, but yet they seem as comfortable as ever. But I'd really like to focus, if we can, not on anyone that you've mentioned there, Max, but Thiago Silva, who just is, I don't know, I don't even know, is Rolls Royce still a thing? I don't know if it's still a car or not, I'm not sure. But
well, we were having this discussion that you know, you can't use Rolls Royce. To update it, it's now sort of Tesla. He's like a Tesla hybrid or something,
okay,
you know.
Right. Okay. He has taken to the Premier League, considering all the question marks against him because of his age. I mean, you can tell, you know, he's just a thoroughbred. It's simple as that. I don't know if a Tesla is a thoroughbred, but he is just a thoroughbred, and he commands the absolute respect. I don't think he came off the pitch with any sweat, but yet he started the third goal with just gracefulness, to be totally honest, and just a thoroughbred. And I think he helps those around him. Chalaba, Rudiger, anyone he plays with at the back there, Christensen, you know, he's a model of what you should be as a defensive player in the hurly-burly of the Premier League, having only been over here a short while and just taken to it like that.
Do you think if he's a Tesla, after the game is over, they just plug him into a charging point for 5 hours, then he's ready to go again
to make
Tuesday.
Sure he's ready for the Champions League, yeah.
Let's move on to the unexpectedly good games bit, featuring Burnley, Crystal Palace, Newcastle and Brentford. David says, should Palace Burnley actually be on every week? Matt said, is there anything Christian Benteke can't do? Producer Joel is trolling you, Barry. Could Benteke win the Golden Boot this season? First off, though, Barry, I mentioned this to you yesterday, but did Chris Wood score the slowest header of all time? I have a feeling he headed it about 5 minutes before it went in. It says the 27th minute. I suspect it actually touched his forehead in about the 21st. I couldn't believe that in the Premier League. That is Sunday League football, right? This ball just sort of hits someone, then it rolls in. I can't believe I saw a goal like that in the Premier League. I was delighted.
Well, it was described on Match of the Day as a precise finish, which I guess is completely fair. And precise finishes aren't exactly what you expect from Chris Wood, who I think is kind of underrated. He's good for 12 goals a season. He rarely gets more. He'll occasionally get less, but it's usually somewhere between 10 and 12. But I think he knew exactly what he was doing and put it in a spot where the goalkeeper couldn't get it. And yeah, that is all I have to say about Chris Wood's precise finish.
Many thanks, Barry. You may stand down.
Didn't Grant Hanley also score an incredibly slow header?
Well, my thought about Grant Hanley's was that someone had inserted a tiny trampoline into the 6-yard box at Carrow Road. Because, I mean, Alex McCarthy, this is all the Norwich Southampton analysis will do, by the way, but he would seem to be at fault for both goals, but that ball really took a bounce that you wouldn't expect. It reminded me of in the Beano when Dennis the Menace would put caps on his dad's golf clubs and then the ball would fly further. I mean, it doesn't scientifically wouldn't make any, actually would probably dull the drive, but that's what it reminded me of, which is not going to attract us any younger listeners, is it, that analogy?
Max, I'm surprised you haven't brought up the Joachim Andersen, Chris Wood, almost trying to pull him down by his top, and then if he didn't get that, it would be by his shorts, and yet play on.
I was coming to
you
that,
sure?
Troy. But,
are you,
you
know, sure?
Yeah. Okay. Okay, I'll prove it. Dyche. Wood is definitely fouled by Andersen, ? Red for me. And then I did go on a tangent where I said, look, you can't expect Simon Hooper to be up with play. Linford Christie wouldn't have been up with play. And then I wondered who your go-to 100-metre runner is these days to compare to some, you know, because obviously I don't think it's the referee's fault, but the linesman there, the referee's assistant, Troy, has to get that.
I thought he should have done because he was in line. Does it go to VAR? It does go to VAR, doesn't it? So there's more eyes on there. I don't know, again, at that stage, I don't know what they're thinking. I don't know why they have decided that that's not a foul, which ultimately is in on goal. I don't care how slow Chris Wood is, but he's in on goal, which ultimately leads to a red card. We had the same scenario in a couple of games, didn't we, a couple of weeks back. Laporte got sent off for Zaha. And I'm struggling to remember the other one that didn't. But
there was a Johnny Evans one, wasn't there?
That was it, the Johnny Evans one. Yeah, that was it. I'm struggling to understand what goes through their minds when, yes, the linesman's missed it, the linesperson, assistant official has missed it, but then it goes to VAR and they stick with the on-field decision. I'm stunned at that. It's a red card. It's a red card.
I'm with the ref.
Wow. Here we go. Here we go.
I haven't heard anyone who agrees with that decision. However, clearly the defender had arms on Wood, but I didn't see a clenched fist. I didn't see him grab or grapple. I didn't see like his hands actually make contact. There was arm on Wood, but I didn't see anything that convinced me that Wood should be going down. I think Wood went down to win a red card and he didn't deserve one. I thought, but generally, I want play to go on unless it has to stop. I want a player to keep running unless he is brought down. And I didn't see Wood get brought down.
We'll agree to disagree.
Newcastle 3, Brentford 3. Eddie Howe missed the opening game of his tenure after testing positive for COVID on Friday. According to Jason Tindall, Howe was calling the shots from his hotel room, which seems like a really nice way to manage football matches, doesn't it? You know, just some of them. So I'd just be in a hotel room. I called Jason Tindall. The high point for me, Barry, was Joel Linton falling over in injury time when he could have scored the winner. But it was a really fun game, this.
Yeah, it was very entertaining. And Joel Linton, despite that loss of balance or whatever it was at the end, played very well for Newcastle. So did Jonjo Shelvey, who was the subject of much ridicule last week when Eddie Howe said that he was going to build his team around Jonjo, you know, in his quarterbacking style and getting the ball forward. I'm not sure what I'd make of this if I was a Newcastle fan. To score 3 goals at home and not win is bad. And they were conspicuously better going forward than they have been of late. But it was still a bit of a circus at the back, and some of their defending was appalling. Presumably that's something Eddie Howe will hope to rule out over time. I keep reading articles in which we're told the central tenet of his management style is to get into the training ground at 5:45 in the morning, something like that. Which I said on Twitter, I get up early every morning. I'm usually up by 6:30 at the very latest, but, you know, it hasn't helped me much in my career. But yeah, there were certainly signs of improvement from Newcastle in a game that could have gone either way, but their defending was often calamitous.
There's a difficult thing for footballers, Troy, isn't there? That there's an obsession with managers getting in really early, and there's an obsession with players being last on the training ground. So, like, actually, the problem is for the caretaker, whoever has to unlock the doors and lock up. They're there all bloody day, aren't they? Is that, you know, from your experience, from Andros's experience, you know, that last on, I've always been sceptical of last on the training ground, because if you have two players at the club who are both last on the training ground, then they're there forever.
No, listen, it generally means that they've stayed out to do a little bit more. They're either working on free kicks, penalties. They drag one of the younger goalkeepers with them. Last on the training ground doesn't mean that at 7 p.m. they're still out there and they've got to wash their own training kit or something like that afterwards. It's just meaning that you're doing a little bit extra. You might go into the gym a little bit longer. It's as simple as that. But we love to over-dramatise, don't we? Last on the training pitch, which must mean that they've put the portable floodlights out as well and made sure that they've still got light to finish
their
session.
He's always first in. He's always last out. Get some other interest.
Last.
Goodness. Like,
Yeah, but don't knock it, because apparently football is not a real job. So apparently they finish at midday, they have their lunch, and then they go home for the rest of the day. So let's not knock that last on the training pitch at all, because it just means that they're doing a little bit extra.
I mean, it isn't a real job, is it? I'm not saying this is, but that isn't, is it? All right.
I'd like to compare the two, Max.
Are you saying that a footballer works harder than me and Barry do? Well, I'm not too sure about that. Right, Newcastle are bottom then, the only team not to get a win this season. Norwich, definitely already relegated, are above them. And we'll do that in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So as mentioned, the tiny trampette at Carrow Road, 6-yard box. Norwich, a 2-1 win over Southampton. Dean Smith's first game in charge. Revenge for the loss he suffered against Southampton a fortnight ago. The Dean Smith bounce. Gilmore and Cantwell restored to the starting 11. Simon, it is interesting that Norwich are, you know, as we've been saying since the third game of the season, they're already down, and yet they're not bottom of the Premier League.
Yeah, and I keep discounting Newcastle from my calculations, because I assume that in January they will sign everyone and then they'll be the only team with players and they'll be all right. But they are bottom of the league. I don't know. I assume that Norwich, that any team that finishes below Norwich will get relegated. I think we can probably say that. But there's no one's cut off, and that this has been, I would say, an unusually competitive league so far. And teams are not safe who you would have thought, like Brentford, for example, who started the season well and do play with great intensity, but they're not getting the results at the moment, and they can be dragged into it very easily. Yeah, the potential is there. I do think that they have a weak squad. And because their squad is weak and their current points tally is low, I think that they will probably be in the bottom three. But where there's life, there's hope, and there's certainly plenty of life.
Thanks to Mark Ridley, who pointed out, in the Times, Dean Smith, it said that Dean Smith watched 5 Norwich games back-to-back on a flight back from New York. Mark pointed out that this would take longer than the average flight time from New York to London. This would suggest the aircraft circling over Heathrow awaiting a landing spot. Smith not sleeping, declining food, ignoring flight safety instructions, speaking to his wife and family. I mean, can you think of anything worse for worse in-flight entertainment? You flick on the TV, you're scrolling through, it says the last five Norwich games. You think, oh, wow, that is really disappointing, isn't it? Anyway, so look, they won. Aston Villa 2, Brighton 0. Barry, Steven Gerrard's first game in charge. He said to the doubters post-match, quote, "I will be as authentic as I can. If anyone doubts me, watch me after those goals. That's real." I mean, it's, as producer Joel says, it's an odd line of reporting, isn't it? He's hardly going to look like he's not bothered. Even if he isn't bothered, you know, then, you know, even if he's just in stepping stone land, of course he's going to look bothered. The whole thing is ridiculous. He's the manager of Aston Villa. He wants them to win games. He's going to be happy when they score late goals.
That is all correct, Max, yes.
What do you want to talk about? Anything? Ollie Watkins' goal? That was good, wasn't it?
So, Ollie Watkins' goal was great. Interesting that Gerrard lined up with Villa. I sort of did an article a few weeks ago about Villa's formations under Dean Smith, which, that kind of thing, is not really my wheelhouse, but I've now become sort of obsessed with how Villa line up at all times and where Emi Buendia plays, whether he plays on the right of a front.
You're getting into work so early, Barry, isn't it? You've got this time to think about it.
Yeah, if I was on a long haul flight, I'd be studying Villa formations over the years. That would be my in-flight entertainment. Just endless Michael Cox articles about Aston Villa's tactics. But yeah, he had Emi Buendia on the right of a three, which is where he should be. Dean Smith tended to play him as a number 10, and it really wasn't working. I thought Tyrone Mings' goal was very good. Also, a bit of a shout out to Jason Steele, who got a very rare start for Brighton, and I thought played very well. He used to be at Sunderland, and he featured quite prominently in one of the series of Sunderland Till I Die.
That's where I know him. I wondered where I knew
him. Where he had a, basically had a, I wouldn't say a breakdown, but a mental unravelment was documented for TV, which I'm not sure was very helpful for his career. But he played outstandingly well in goal for Brighton. I really wanted him to have a good game, but even though he lost, he made three very good saves. But I'm probably being unfair on him. He had a crisis of confidence, which was documented for this very popular series, and I probably hasn't helped him in his career progression. That's what I should have said. But yeah, it was a great result for Villa and Steven Gerrard.
Well, what I would say is that there was one new manager on Saturday saying, like literally saying, look at how I behave on the bench. That is how invested I am. And there was another new manager who was, in not in so many words, all look at me, look how invested I am at White Hart Lane. And I thought that Gerrard's comments were interesting, mainly because Conte was doing his performing monkey act at Tottenham.
Yeah, well, let's move on to that game. I think it's interesting, his performing monkey act, isn't it? Because I just think sometimes, there was one point with like 2 minutes to go when he was going around going, come on, come on, come on. And it's a bit like the guy on the terrace is going, why aren't you singing? And you just want to go, I just don't feel like singing right now. I know I want to be part of the support. If you're a Spurs fan with a season ticket, and Nuno left you alone, really, you know, he never told. And now suddenly you've got to dance the dance. What did you make of this game, Troy? It looked to me like Antonio Conte didn't take over until the second half, because the first half, his tactics were completely wrong. Like it was really deep. There was no intensity. It looked exactly like Tottenham have looked all season.
Yeah, and I think you kind of got to look at Spurs and realise that he's dealing with the same players that obviously Nuno had, that, you know, he got one great result out of, which was the Man City result, first game of the season, and never seemed to galvanise those players again. With Conte, what you're going to get, you're going to get to know him during those breaks. And halftime was the moment where he could obviously get into the players. And they were, you know, they were booed off at halftime as well. So let's not forget that. So they may have been dancing after 93 minutes, but they were booed off at halftime. And he got into them. And you saw an intensity. You saw a remarkable difference in the way that they played. And he's going to expect that all the time. And those Tottenham players are going to have to expect a rollicking. But everyone knows what he's like on the touchline. That is him. We've seen him up and down from corner flag to corner flag almost. So that is what you're going to get from him. And I do think those fans need pumping up at times, because let's remember as well, this was the guy that they didn't want in their club in the summer. And he's now here. And all of a sudden I'm hearing all Tottenham fans come out and saying like he's the best thing again since that slice of bread that everyone keeps using. So I think he got into the players. I think he's got big problems still. Harry Kane doesn't look Harry Kane. Song doesn't look Son still. For me, anyway, Moura looks the most proactive of those front three. And he's got some work to do, but no doubt he'll be given money in January and we'll use that very, very wisely. But again, Leeds were very good, but Leeds are in trouble. We're talking about that bottom group. Leeds are in trouble. Bielsa, you know, is it second season syndrome for them? They're going about their work the same way, not with the same intensity, I suppose, throughout the 90 minutes. They've not got Bamford. He may need to sign a centre-forward in January. And I think they've got to be looking over their shoulders as well.
I thought Leeds played very well, but you have to factor in the missing trio of Rafinha, Rodrigo and Bamford. Like that is a huge loss.
Oh, Barry, you didn't want to factor in for Everton, no? When I said, you know, Dominic Calvert-Lewin and now you're factoring in three injured players, yeah?
Yeah, but Leeds only lost 2-1 and played quite well.
Yeah, but they played a Spurs. They should be winning there. No, you're right. You're right.
I thought Calvin Phillips looked so good at centre-back.
It was tremendous.
He? What a play he is. And actually, I've always liked Adam Forshaw. I didn't know where he was. And he's a lovely pass. He's a lovely passer of football. And Tottenham don't seem to have anyone who can pass it still. I'll be interested to see what they do in the window.
I don't think Conte will have that free. Højbjerg, yes, but he'll be looking for two others in there. because they're beating Leeds in 45 minutes, having turned it around. But they won't be beating many teams with a midfield three like that.
Ryan Sessegnon's first game for Spurs in 22 months, by the way. He's played at, I think, Hoffenheim and other places as well. Finally, Wolves 1, West Ham 0. Lovely to see Raul Jimenez scoring. It was a lovely move. It was a lovely finish. Simon says, dear Pod, can we have a bit of a shout-out to how well Wolves are brackets quietly doing at the moment, please? Up to sixth after the West Ham game. This despite great performances but poor results at the start of the season. Raul starting to look back to his best too. From Simon.
I think whoever sent in the email has pretty much nailed it. They were playing well and getting beaten at the start of the season. Now they're playing well and winning. And they're very impressive. Also impressive was Connor Cody on Match of the Day 2 last night. He was very good, I thought. And there looks to be an interesting documentary about the injury to Raul Jimenez, which I think he suffered a year ago today or yesterday or something. That serious head injury on the BBC iPlayer for anyone who has access to it. That looks well worth a look.
Now, in Scotland, Hibs beat Rangers 3-1 and Celtic beat St Johnstone in the semi-finals of the Scottish League Cup. Giovanni Van Bronckhorst is going to take over as Rangers manager. But I want to talk about the sending off of Funso Ojo for Aberdeen against Dundee United. Troy, you were tweeting about this. It's a sort of mad situation. Describe what happened.
So the ball has run out. He's tried to win the ball in the box and it's run out of play. And his momentum has carried him over the hoardings, right facing up to the Dundee United crowd. And a member of the crowd has decided to push him quite fiercely in the chest. Ojo has then gone to that person who's pushed him. And literally they've had a moment where they're just staring at each other. Other members of the crowd are coming in, no doubt shouting obscenities to him. And he's walked away, jumped back over the hoardings, seemed to get some kind of comfort from Dundee United players. And then the ref walks up to him and gives him what is obviously a second yellow card and then a red card. Apparently it's the letter of the law, because what he's done is he's almost made a movement back to the person that's pushed him quite fiercely, as if to say, what are you doing kind of thing? Which you're not allowed to do, because it incites the crowd that have just pushed him, physically abused him. I can't understand. Apparently the rule is correct if you do that and you make a movement back to the crowd, but I can't understand it at all.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, you can change laws, so that is something that needs to be looked at, and the guy who pushes him should be banned from football. And it's, you know,
his manager has kind of said, well, it is a bit of his fault. And I'm looking at what point do managers shut up and just defend their players, to be fair. He said it is a bit of his fault because, you know, he did, you know, go towards the aggressor again. And I just think to myself, something's going to happen sooner rather than later. And I don't want it to happen, but something's going to happen on the field of play where a player is struck or whatever it may be. We saw last night again in France, I don't know if you saw, you know, hit by a bottle again. That's the second time this season. So something's going to happen. If players are not protected, you know, the entertainers, they're at their place of work. And I don't think people get it, to be totally honest.
Philippe's on later this week. We'll talk about that Ligue 1 thing with him. We won't bother Philippe with Ligue 1. He's better than that. Cambridge v Sunderland on Saturday, Barry, the big one. Adam says, the man of the match, Zach Williams for Crewe versus Gilling, was not old enough to win a bottle of champagne. He was awarded a packet of Jaffa Cakes and a packet of crisps, which is nice. Jim says, I'm not sure if you've ever seen this before. I saw it in a discount shop earlier today. Should I buy it? It's a CD called A League of Their Own. And it's an album. Shall I read you some of the hits? That's Life. It starts with That's Life by Ron Atkinson. The front has a picture of Ali McCoy's Chris Kamara, Dion Dublin, Alan Mullery. Frank Sinclair sings track two, Angel Eyes. Then Ali McCoist and Gabby Logan, Something Stupid. Then Babylon. David Gray's Babylon, sung by Matt Janssen, who also does Walking in Memphis, track eight. And Matt Janssen does Song for Guy, a piano solo, as the last. It's an utterly baffling Pennies from Heaven, sung by Alan Mullery. And track 13, Ali McCoy's True to Type, Donald, Where's Your Trousers? A Brown Eyed Girl Chris Kamara, and Dion Dunlin does a saxophone solo of My Favourite Things. Please, Jim, will you buy this and let us know how it sounds? It's an extraordinary album.
If Jim bought that, he could probably get it signed by most, if not all, of the artists involved, and then sell it on eBay for possibly twice as much as he paid for it originally.
It's on for a pound. Yeah. So, you know, let us know, Jim. A few emails to get through, everybody, and then you can all go. This one is from Dr. Patrick Gildersleeve, who says, hi, all. I've enjoyed various Wikipedia discussions recently and Johnny Liu's comments that Wikipedia should be for things like the Second World War, carbon and the human genome prompted me to write in. I've recently completed a PhD in data science, studying the interplay of news events and Wikipedia, including but not limited to football matches. Wikipedia, through the technology of the World Wide Web, has redefined traditional notions of what an encyclopedia should be and blurred the lines between news and history. In fact, current events form many of the most popular topics and much of the new information added to the site, with football proving particularly popular. Having said that, I'm not sure all of Barry's anecdotes should qualify for preservation in humanity's definitive reference work. Through my research, I'm able to provide answers to another debate on the last pod. In recent work with some colleagues, we quantified the effect of anticipating versus reminiscing about football matches using Wikipedia data. Page views towards football clubs' Wikipedia articles build up in anticipation of a match, peak when they play, and eventually fade back down to regular levels as people reminisce or try to forget. Typically, this reminiscing period lasts about six times longer than the anticipating period. We look back on past matches more than we look forward to future matches. In addition, when a team wins, the reminiscing period lasts about four times longer, four and a half times longer than when they lose. Finally, I took a look at the recent page views for Max and Barry's Wikipedia articles. Before the podcast Wikipedia discussions, Max averaged 131 page views a day and Barry 102. Since the discussion, Barry's page views peaked at a whopping 1,571 and now average 460 per day, compared to a more modest rise to 243 for Max. It's a little hard to definitively compare, but in terms of Premier League captains, this would put Barry in 14th place behind Ben Mee and above Moussa Sissoko, and will put Max in 16th place behind James Ward-Prowse, but above Grant Hanley. I hope your newfound level of fame doesn't get to your heads. All the best, Dr. Patrick Gildersleeve. That's very kind. Most of the Wikipedia chat was while you weren't here, Barry. Anyway, finally, from Chris. Hello, I've recently had minor surgery on my jaw, and as a result, I've had time to catch up on some of the pods I've missed. Thank you for your Merson special, which was brilliant, honest, funny, thought-provoking, even made my wife want to read the book. Also, the John Barnes pod, which challenged again, needed to be heard. On a different note, I've had some Tramadol for pain relief, and I've had a series of vivid dreams, which always seem to involve Barry in some way. To be clear, I don't normally dream of Barry, but he's turned up as an Uber driver in a Ford Sierra with no front doors, a dog trainer, and most recently, he was having a haircut on Ferndale Road in Brixton in a barber's shop in the post office while drinking absinthe. I'm getting off the painkillers as soon as possible. Keep up the good work, Chris. Barry, have you ever driven a Ford Sierra without any front doors as an Uber driver?
No, I've never been an Uber driver. I used to own a Ford Focus, which did have okay. front doors.
I would say that any drug that causes nighttime visions of Barry has no right to call itself a painkiller.
Well, I mean, Tramadol is powerful stuff. It's been the subject of some controversy in cycling circles. I think it's banned now, but it used to be. So a lot of cyclists used to drink sort of Tramadol shakes towards the end of stages to stop their muscles aching, and it's very addictive. So I hope our correspondent doesn't get addicted and then continue to have dreams about me for the rest of his life.
Is that why Bradley Wiggins didn't like you, Barry? Because he'd had been having fever dreams about you escorting him everywhere, and then he had to see you in the flesh. Anyway,
I've just seen Barry go from the star of Wikipedia to someone that drives an Uber with no doors, and the looks on his face are absolutely brilliant.
Right, that'll do for today. We got through a lot, and I think we did it in reasonably good time. So thank you. Cheers, Barry.
Thank you, Max.
Cheers, Simon.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Troy.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Max.
Champions League this week, so Wednesday and Thursday we'll be back.
This is The Guardian.